From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Bernice Johnson Reagan. In the Civil Rights Movement, she sang with the SNCC Freedom Singers. Now she's a scholar of movement songs and the founder of the a cappella group Sweet Honey and the Rock. Also today, I speak with Tony Houston. He wrote the screenplay for The Dead, the last movie directed by his father, John Houston. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Globe of Frogs, the new album from Robin Hitchcock and the Egyptians, which is topping the college charts. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Frantic, starring Harrison Ford, directed by Roman Polanski. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Bernice Johnson Reagan has sung freedom songs at civil rights marches and sit-ins, at organizing rallies, and in prison. She was a founding member of the Freedom Singers, who were affiliated with SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. When the Freedom Singers disbanded, Reagan founded the Georgia-based Harambe Singers, and later the a cappella group Sweet Honey and the Rock. With Sweet Honey, Reagan continues to sing freedom songs and spirituals, and she updates these traditions with new songs written by her and by other members of the group. Reagan has also become one of America's leading scholars of freedom songs. She produced a record series called Voices from the Civil Rights Movement for the Smithsonian Institution. She also directs the Smithsonian's program in Black American culture. And she has a new book of collected songs called Compositions One. Bernice Reagan, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
I want to play, before we talk about your life, I want to play an excerpt of a recent record of yours called Rivers of Life, in which you do all the voices. It sounds like a small a cappella group, but it is all you over tracking. Why did you want to record that way?
I've worked a long time with other singers, and I find that there are some things I can teach and some things I have not yet been able to convey. So with this project and technology, I'm able to come a little closer within the context of what my range is in the studio.
So you can do everything you hear in your head?
To do what I can hear in my head. I cannot perform most of those lines on a stage, but with a studio and composing, I can do it.
We're going to hear Guide My Feet While I Run This Race. Now, how did you first learn this song?
I don't know. I don't remember not knowing the song. Therefore, I probably learned it in church. And there is a part of my repertoire that seemed to have come to me by me growing up in a Black community, in a Black church, and Guide My Feet is one of those songs.
This is Bernice Johnson Reagan from her latest album, River of Life. Bernice Johnson Reagan's latest album, River of Life, and again, she's doing all the voices on that through overdubbing. Now, you dedicate that album to the singing tradition of the Black American Baptist Church, especially the Mount Early Baptist Church in Worth County, Georgia, where you were baptized. What was the singing tradition you came up in?
Well, I call it an unrehearsed congregational style. And what I mean by that is there is a way in which a song is started by a song leader, and the rest of the people in the church come in and join and actually make the song.
That's kind of what you were doing by yourself with
that's
all of
right.
your voices on
so,
the recording
so
we just heard.
That's what influences me most when I am creating choral music, that particular congregational tradition.
Now, did you sing in a choir or did the whole congregation sing together?
I sang in a choir. This style is older than what is called gospel music. When I sang in a choir, I was in a gospel choir. The first difference is you call a rehearsal, you learn the songs, you learn the part. The congregational style, there is never a rehearsal call as long as you live to learn a song, either words, text, styles, harmonies. There is no training session separate from going to church, and you learn while you are doing the singing.
Now, your father was a Baptist preacher. Did you hear much secular music when you were growing up, or was it mostly church music?
I heard secular music, but in the early years growing up, my family was fairly strict, so that they did not care that much for us listening to secular music. By the time I got to teenage, my brother, who's 2 years older than me, would get my mother's radio and take it into the room, and he would play Randy. Now, Randy out of Nashville played blues between midnight and day.
This is a disc jockey.
That's right. And I learned about Screaming Jay Hawkins, Howlin' Wolf, Lightning Hopkins, all of the blues, B.B. King, between midnight and day, listening to the radio coming into my room. By the time we got into high school, things had just sort of loosened up in the family so that there was more space and more permission to hear and play rhythm and blues, especially, and I actually participated in a rhythm and blues group.
Now, you went to college at Albany College, which was a black college in Georgia.
Georgia.
You were a music major when you
yes.
went to college. What kind of music were you studying?
The Euroclassical tradition. I was a contralto, so I was studying Italian arias and German lieder.
That's very interesting, since you were so steeped in the music of the church, to start singing a lieder, an art song.
Well, within the school system, the black school system, when you get to high school, if you're a singer, you begin to do anthems. You learn the Hallelujah Chorus. You learn Alleluia. You learn The Heavens Are Telling. There are staples of the Euroclassical concert tradition. You're trained to sing, and you get your first lesson in that bel canto style where you sort of cover the voice. And you learn that in high school, so by the time you go to college, you also are operating in that tradition. You could not, when I was in college, learn gospel in school. If you sang gospel, you learned it in church. Today you will find on university campuses gospel choirs. But when I was going to school, the music departments actually frowned on the traditional black vocal song style. So you never received any training in it, and you were basically told if you were considered a good soloist, that if you sang gospel, you would ruin your voice.
When you started to sing with the Freedom Singers, did you feel like you were turning your back on what you were supposed to be doing, learning more about the European singing tradition?
That decision didn't come that hard. The first thing I decided was I was going to be in the movement.
Right.
That got me put in jail. In jail, the only logical songs were the songs that had come out of the black church. The style I'd always sang those songs in were the black vocal style. And therefore, it was like I chose to be in the movement, and the movement sort of named the musical content that would work. By the time I got out of jail, I never wanted to leave the relationship I found between singing and a political position. And it was in jail where I found that you could sing a song and it would say exactly what you felt. I'd never experienced that before. But once I experienced it, I made the choice that I would stay with that. And have not changed. Since that time, I have studied voice. I'm always working with a voice teacher. Most of them operate in that Euroclassical vocal tradition. And there are times in Sweet Honey when we use the coloring that is associated with it, but we don't take it seriously.
My guest is Bernice Johnson Reagan. She's the founder of Sweet Honey and the Rock. She was a founding member of the Freedom Singers, and she also directs the Black American Culture Project at the Smithsonian Institution. So let's see, what did you just say, that becoming active in the movement got you thrown out of college and into prison?
Got me thrown into prison, and then
thrown
the college,
out of college
suspended those of us who were arrested.
Why would a black college administration throw out of college a student for their activism in the Black Civil Rights Movement?
These are state colleges. They are state colleges in the Georgia State University system. There were three black colleges in Georgia, Fort Valley, Savannah, and Albany State. A lot of the response of the administration was left to the administration. I actually was arrested after I had finished my final exams. So the administration could have said that this is off-campus activity, and therefore, you know, we have nothing to do with it. This is what the black college president at Fort Valley State College said when the Georgia Education Board asked about the Fort Valley students picketing and getting arrested. His name was Troop. He said, well, they're off campus and it's we don't have jurisdiction. The Albany State Administration sent the dean of students down to the jail and got the names of those students who were registered. And we were suspended for conduct unbecoming a student of Albany State College. So that administration reached further than it needed to. And I think it has to do with what we would have called then Uncle Tom-ism, or just fear around what you have to do to keep and protect your job.
Right.
And that was a real crisis within every black community. There were members of the community who absolutely felt totally threatened by those of us who participated in the movement and would cooperate or spy or report on us with the white power structure.
Can you describe how the Freedom Singers were founded?
Albany, Georgia was a singing movement. And when the news reporters began to come down, they came down in December 62 as a result of King being arrested. I was already in jail, so I missed most of that. But what they began to write about was the singing. No matter what the article said, they talked about singing. For the first time in my life, I realized that even black people who came to Albany from other places were hearing singing on a level they'd never heard it before. I grew up in Albany. I never knew that there was anything different about the choral congregational style in Albany. But the students who came out of Nashville to organize, Andrew Young, who came out of Louisiana with King to Albany to organize, Dorothy Cotton out of Petersburg, Virginia, they all talked about the singing in Albany being like no other singing they had ever heard. And as a result of that, Cordell Regan, who was a SNCC field secretary, and James Foreman, who was executive director of SNCC, began to talk about forming a group. Pete Seeger was somebody who suggested that a group of singers traveling might actually help to build support for those parts of movement activity that did not get on the news. And SNCC was at that point trying to go into what they call black belt areas. These are areas in the South where black people outnumbered whites, usually 3-1. And if we could break into voter registration in those areas, it would really turn around political power. But knocking on doors and getting people to register to vote is not the same as getting 700 people arrested. and press was very difficult to get. So the Freedom Singers came out of a need to have another kind of structure to generate support about that kind of organizing activity.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your work with the Freedom Singers and then talk about the work that you're doing now, but we're going to take a short break first. My guest is Bernice Johnson Reagan, who is a founding member of the Freedom Singers, founder of Sweet Honey and the Rock, the a cappella group, and she directs the Black American Culture Project at the Smithsonian Institution. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Bernice Johnson Reagan is my guest. We call the songs that you sang freedom songs, but some of them were spiritual, some of them were old slave songs too, weren't they?
I mean, the freedom songs came out of the repertoire first, the standard repertoire of what you were singing, so that you would have a song like Paul and Silas bound in jail, had no money for to go to bail. Keep your eyes on the prize, hold on. That's a spiritual. But that song just moves straight into civil rights movement activity, and you can understand it. If you're in the Black church, you learn about Paul and Silas being locked up in jail. They were really radical SNCC workers. They are the first Christian organizers into Europe. And they go into this town, and they're preaching, and they throw them in jail. They start to sing and pray. And as a result, the jail let them out. Well, even though they preach about this in the Black church, if you grew up in a Black family, the best badge you can have is that you never got into trouble with the law. So at the same time you're preaching about these radical Christians organizing going forth, you're trying to really stay cool within your society. When you're in the civil rights movement, that's the first time you establish yourself in a relationship that's pretty close to the same relationship that used to get the Christians thrown in the lion's den. And so for the first time, those old songs you understand in a way that nobody could ever teach you. So that songs like Hold On, Eyes on the Prize, Hold On, Old Freedom, This Little Light of Mine, We Shall Not Be Moved, We Shall Overcome, all of those songs were church songs. But they got new meaning as a part of the civil rights movement. Added to that were new songs that people created.
Well, you created some new songs and changed some of the words to traditional songs. What was the first song you did that with?
Old Freedom. Over My Head, I See Freedom in the Air. That was the first demonstration in Albany, Georgia. And we had never walked in that kind of line in the city of Albany in its history. And we circled the courthouse twice. This is 1961, November. The ICC ruling, that's the Interstate Commerce Commission, had ruled that transportation across state lines could not be segregated. So students had been arrested for trying to buy tickets in the white ticket counter, and we demonstrated into support. Once we finished that demonstration, we couldn't go back to the campus, and we went to a Black church, which is the only place in the community we had to go. And I remember Charles Jones, who was a SNCC field secretary, we got in there together, and he said, Bernice, sing a song. And I started, Over My Head, I See Freedom in the Air. Well, the song really is, Over My Head, I See Trouble in the Air. Well, at that point, I did not see any trouble. So when I got down the line and got to the word trouble, trouble didn't come out, freedom came out. And the end of the line, there must be a God somewhere. So that was the first song that I changed.
You know, you must have also really had to know what song to sing under which circumstances? Because there were times probably you needed to sing a song to help organize people. Other times you needed to sing a song to help people find their courage to stand up to what was about to happen. Did you intuitively have a sense of what song to do when?
The song that you're supposed to sing that suits the occasion comes up in you if you're in the occasion yourself. So you don't have to make a list if you yourself are a part of what's happening. The song will just come up. If you're a song leader in the Black tradition, you're socialized as a song leader to know a wide range of songs, and you see people coming up with songs all of the time in church and actually at football games. Everywhere in the Black community there's music, there's this selection and picking. And usually there's never a naming, now we are going to sing. Somebody starts up a song. If they are good leaders, it's the right song for the moment. So that's something you learn.
Was there a time when you were with the Freedom Singers, an example of a time where you sang a certain song and it really kind of changed the mood or brought the mood to the next level?
The singing with the Freedom Singers is different in a way than singing in the movement on the scene. By the time we formed the Freedom Singers, we were transporting a microcosm experience. So we would be these four people standing in this hall singing and talking about the movement. But many times in the movement, one of the strongest things was a song called This May Be the Last Time. It's a song that is a powerful mood setter. You can't really sing the song without thinking about the statement you're making. And it says, this may be the last time, maybe the last time, I don't know. Maybe the last time we all sing together. Maybe the last time we all pray together. Many times, that song would be done just before a march. And it would make you know something of the potential cost that you were going into in taking the stand you were taking.
When the Freedom Singers split up and when there weren't a constant, when there weren't constant rallies to sing at and demonstrations, did you feel lost for a while trying to figure out what to do with your singing and what to do? To do with your life, even.
Cordell and I got married,
mm-hmm.
So that I left the Freedom Singers before the Freedom Singers split up.
Oh, I see.
And I had my first child in 64. I traveled with the Freedom Singers in 63. There was another group of Freedom Singers formed, but I was being a mother in Atlanta. I had a period where I had to decide if I was going to do anything. And it was a period of deciding whether I was going to be a singer and if being a mother and a wife meant that I was not going to be a singer. Or if not being in the Freedom Singers, did that mean I was not going to be a singer? So there was a period where I had to really work at that. One wonderful thing that happened after I had my second child in 65, Toshi Seeger called me and she asked. My baby was maybe 2 months old. She asked me to do a TV show on Woody Guthrie. It was a Camera 3 show. Now, I will never forget it because here I was with two children, and I'm sure Toshi was understanding in some way that I wasn't clear about how I was going to manage this singing. And then it was like somebody just reached down and said, come and sing. And she got tickets. I flew to New York, did the TV show. But it was very important. It says, you can have two children and you can sing. But at various points in my life, I remember one point in my life, there was a woman who was opening a club in Atlanta. And she came to my house and asked me to sing in the club. And it was called The Loving Spoonful. It was very important to me that at a time when I was trying to figure out there were people watching me knowing I was going through that transition, and they affirmed me every time as a singer. That was very important.
You sing now with Sweet Honey and the Rock, an a cappella group that you founded. And through that group, you are adding new songs to the repertoire, new politically inspired songs and spiritually inspired songs. But where else do you think the new songs are coming from today? The civil rights movement is not contributing songs in the way that it was. Do you think that there is a movement now that is furthering that tradition?
The civil rights movement did not stay in the black community. The civil rights movement is the movement war against Vietnam, is the women's movement, is the homosexual rights movement, is the anti-nuke movement, is the whole issue of South Africa, Central America, is an extension of the foundation laid for this period for organizing within this particular society. Therefore, all of the musicians you are hearing about now, who in addition to all of the other songs they make and record, will write songs about particular social and political issues, are doing exactly what we did, and doing more probably than the commercial artists did in the 60s. And I think that it's something that really needs to be looked at. But I think these people are a product out of the 60s, where the civil rights music, which stayed outside of the commercial industry by and large, made a major impact on what music is and what music can do. And it is influencing artists today.
You're in the unusual position of being a scholar of the movement that you contributed to. You know, you were one of the Freedom Singers, but now as a scholar, you have been collecting songs from the movement and going back and documenting sound recordings from the civil rights movement. Have you learned things that you weren't aware of then that were happening around you? I mean, have you gotten a different perspective as a scholar than the perspective that you had as a participant?
Absolutely. I was a SNCC worker, which means I was a radical, and I considered myself in the vanguard, and I saw everything else from that point of view. Being a scholar gives me a chance to back way up and look at a much broader picture. There were things that I didn't know about, for instance, around the March of Washington 63. I knew nothing about the mobilization happening in the labor unions with the churches, the National Council of Churches, to pull that march off. All of that knowing I have only learned as a scholar.
Well, I want to thank you very much for sharing some of your research and your personal experiences with us. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. I enjoyed talking with you.
I enjoyed it, too. My guest has been Bernice Johnson Reagan, and she directs the Black American Culture Project at the Smithsonian Institution and founded the a cappella women's group Sweet Honey in the Rock, which is performing across the country throughout February, which is Black History Month. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with New York Times reporter Martin Tolchin. He's just written a new book titled Buying into America, How Foreign Money is Changing the Face of Our Nation. I hope you can join us. Here's Bernice Reagan from her new album, River of Life, singing Buses Are A-Coming.
Buses are a-coming, oh yes. Buses are a-coming, oh yes. Buses are buses are a-coming, buses are a-coming, oh yes. Better get you ready, oh yes. Better get you ready, oh yes. Better get you ready.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. It's an intimidating task for a screenwriter to adapt a James Joyce short story. Coming up, we'll find out how Tony Houston handled the challenge. He wrote the screenplay for The Dead, the last film directed by his father, John Houston. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Globe of Frogs by Robin Hitchcock and the Egyptians. Ken says the quirky and bleak lyrics have helped make the album a hit on college campuses. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Frantic, the new thriller starring Harrison Ford. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt. The civilian president of Panama today ordered military strongman General Manuel Antonio Noriega to step down from his post as chief of that nation's armed forces. Noriega has been indicted by a federal grand jury in the United States on drug and racketeering charges. The White House this evening expressed support for the Panamanian president's action. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
President Eric Arturo de Valla, in a broadcast announcement today, said he had no alternative than to separate General Noriega from his high post so that justice can take its course without pressure of any kind. De Valla met Tuesday with Noriega. U.S. officials were aware that the ouster was coming, said State Department spokesman Bud Jacobs, quote, "We knew about it." White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater issued a statement this evening. At this time, said Fitzwater, "We want to reiterate our unqualified support for civilian constitutional rule in Panama." Fitzwater continued, "There is but one legitimate sovereign authority in Panama, and that is the Panamanian people exercising their democratic right to vote and elect their leadership in a free society." There's been no reaction from either Noriega or the armed forces in Panama. As for U.S. troops stationed in the country, a Pentagon spokesman said there's been no change in their normal alert status. I'm Brian Naylor in Washington.
Two more Palestinians were shot to death today by Israeli troops during widespread unrest linked to the arrival of Secretary of State George Shultz. Soldiers also arrested 100 Arabs suspected in yesterday's West Bank lynching of an Israeli collaborator. Security was extremely tight at Tel Aviv Airport as Shultz arrived for a five-day Mideast peace mission. He said continuing unrest in the Israeli-occupied West Bank and Gaza underscores the fact that the status quo is no longer an option. He said he had brought to Israel a workable proposal to get peace negotiations started. This week, the Democrats on the House Judiciary Committee considered and rejected a proposal to begin an impeachment investigation of Attorney General Edwin Meese. NPR's Nina Totenberg has more.
The chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Peter Rodino, this week convened a meeting of his various subcommittee chairmen in part to discuss the idea of beginning an impeachment investigation. According to a number of congressmen who attended the meeting, the clear consensus was against impeachment. All who spoke to NPR about the meeting did so on condition of anonymity, but both liberal and conservative Democrats were unified in their thinking that impeachment now is a bad idea. Their reasons were both political and procedural. Said one congressman, "Meese is twisting slowly in the wind. Why should we cut him down? He's their problem, not ours." Said another, "We just look like we were trying to impeach him for political reasons, and the Democrats would end up looking like a bunch of political thugs beating up on some poor, wounded doe." Several congressmen noted that there would be serious procedural problems in impeachment as well, since Meese's activities are currently under investigation by a special prosecutor. A spokesman for the Attorney General this afternoon had no comment. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
The government today revised upward its fourth quarter economic growth figures. The Commerce Department says the gross national product rose 4.5%, 0.3% better than a preliminary report 1 month ago. Economist Roger Brinner says the figures for the last 3 months of 1987 suggest the economy is not headed for a recession.
I think that it does suggest that the economy is adjusting reasonably well to the stock market crash, and that a classic recession is not in the cards.
But other economists are less optimistic. They point out that much of the rise in economic growth comes from big increases in business inventories. Slack demand left firms with large quantities of unsold goods and could lead to a production slowdown in the months ahead. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped more than 22 points to close at 2017.57. Declines led advances. You're listening to NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of the new album from Robin Hitchcock and the Egyptians. Its title, Globe of Frogs, is as cryptic as most of the lyrics on the album. Hitchcock claims The Doors, The Birds, John Lennon, and Syd Barrett from early Pink Floyd as prime musical influences.
What can I say to you?
What can I say to you, asks Robin Hitchcock at the start of that song. It's a phrase that boils down the complications of his new album. Hitchcock and his band The Egyptians have made a record that is essentially about the impossibility of communicating one's true feelings to anyone else. This isn't what we usually think of as rock and roll subject matter, but is it any wonder that Hitchcock is a major star on college radio stations? College radio comprises what little adventurousness still exists in rock music broadcasting. That audience has seized upon the work of this Englishman and turned him into a pop soothsayer, and Hitchcock seems to relish that role. That's a song called Flesh No One, Beetle Dennis. And don't worry, Robin Hitchcock doesn't really want you to glean any sense from the title. The song itself, however, is pretty clear, if not obvious. It's a good example of Hitchcock's songwriting strategy throughout this album. A clear, strong pop melody surrounds a dense, bleak lyric. As you heard, Hitchcock croons soulfully, "There's nothing happening to you that means anything at all." There's a line of easy, unearned despair running through much of Robin Hitchcock's work that I find alternately annoying and amusing. I think this is one way to account for his college popularity, since college is often a place to learn the difference between glib cynicism and a realistic worldview. And Hitchcock really lays it on with a trowel in a statement he's written for the back cover of Globe of Frogs. He calls it a manifesto, so I guess we should pay attention. Hitchcock writes, "This album does not deal with conventional problems of so-called real life, relationships, injustice, politics, and central heating systems, about which it's notoriously hard to talk because orthodox lines of cliché have been devised." A bit later, he concludes, "My contention is, and it's a bloody obvious one, that beneath our civilized glazing, we are all deviants, all alone, and all peculiar. This flies in the face of mass marketing," says Hitchcock, "but I'm sticking with it." Well, this sort of thing doesn't fly in the face of mass marketing at all. Rock fans eat up that kind of melodramatic philosophizing. Those sentiments wouldn't be out of place on the back of a Jethro Tull album. But lots of good art has been created out of obviousness, and Globe of Frogs has a number of very good songs. I refuse, for example, to let the cheesy irony in the lyrics of Balloon Man spoil the pleasure to be taken from its jaunty music.
I was walking up 6th Avenue when Balloon Man came right up to me. He was round and fat and spherical with the biggest grin I'd ever seen. He bounced on up toward me, but before we could be introduced, he blew up very suddenly. I guess his name.
There are many pleasurable moments on Globe of Frogs, but there's only one time when everything Robin Hitchcock is trying to achieve comes together. There's a song called Sleeping with Your Devil Mask that's pretty stunning. For once, despair gives way to sensuousness. Hitchcock can't seem to write straightforwardly about romance or sex, but the whole subject seems to focus his considerable powers here. Devil Mask is the song in which Robin Hitchcock earns all that despair, because he makes his best jokes about it.
I see the buddy.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Robin Hitchcock and the Egyptians' new album is titled Globe of Frogs. This is Fresh Air. Tony Huston is the son of the great director John Huston, whose films include The Maltese Falcon, The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, Key Largo, and more recently, Pritzi's Honor. When Tony Huston was growing up, he didn't get to see much of his busy father, but father and son became close collaborators toward the end of John Huston's life. Tony wrote the screenplay for his father's last film, The Dead, and was with his father while the film was shot. This new film stars Tony's sister, Angelica Huston. It was Tony Huston's intimidating task to adapt the screenplay from the James Joyce short story, The Dead.
It would have been intimidating if I hadn't been so familiar with it. I had the advantage that I had read the story at least 20 years beforehand and had even discussed the possibility of making it into a film with Dad at that time. So it had been in my subconscious for a while.
It seems to me, though, when you're working with James Joyce, it's a kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. If you change any of the dialogue that James Joyce wrote, then you could be criticized for changing the words of the master. On the other hand, if you don't change anything he wrote, you'd be accused of not having much of a job as a screenwriter. It's a tricky situation.
Well, because it's a short story, the main thing that I had to do was to expand it. And this, if I had been dealing with Ulysses, the kind of accusation you make might have been justified. But in the case of The Dead, when I reduced it to the things that one could actually show on the screen, I ended up with something that was about 35, 40 minutes long. And that meant I had to find another 35 or 40 minutes in order to justify it being made into a feature film.
How did you do that? How did you find the other thread that would expand the story?
In particular, I approached it from what Joyce himself indicated in the story, that there were areas which might be expanded. that Joyce might make reference to the fact that somebody was heard laughing in an adjacent room. Well, what would that person be laughing about? And that would generate a scene.
You first read The Dead around 20 years ago, and you'd read it many times over the intervening years. What was it about the story that has such special meaning for you?
First of all, that no matter how well you think you know somebody, you never know them really. The fact that you can live with somebody for many, many years and they can still be mainly submerged. Then there's also another thing, which is that most films which involve a married couple deal with a member of the marriage and their relationship with somebody on the outside. There are lots of films about adultery and, you know, etc. But there are relatively few films which deal with the business of two people living together over a long period of time and having to make adjustments to each other where they're not threatened by something external.
Was this meant to be a family project? Your sister is a starring actress, your father directed it, you wrote the screenplay. Was that part of the idea, or did that just happen?
Well, if it was the idea, Dad didn't let us know this from the word go by any means. The first that I knew that Angelica was going to participate was when Dad was in hospital here, and I'd come over having written the first draft, and Dad was blind. He'd just had cataract surgery, and he got me to read my first draft. And then a couple of days later, I heard that he had got Angelica to read my first draft aloud. And suddenly I said, Dad's planning to bring Angelica in on this.
Now, when you were working with him, I suppose he would have treated you like a screenwriter as opposed to like a son.
I really had something quite remarkable with Dad during the last 2 years of his life. I'd been a struggling writer, and Dad, out of the blue, just decided to teach me what he knew. And I was also ripe for his influence. You know, there is this problem between sons and fathers and trying to establish one's own identity. Well, it took me until I was 35 to be able to deal with Dad as an apprentice. And that's what I started off as, and now I'm a fully-fledged screenwriter.
Your father was not in good health when he directed The Dead. He directed from a wheelchair. He was hooked up to an oxygen machine. How was he able to maintain his directorial control when he was so physically disabled?
Because directing has got to do with the force of somebody's mind. It's got nothing to do with physicality. And the fact that he was attached to an oxygen tank and couldn't walk more than 20 or 30 feet was irrelevant.
You were with him, I think, as he was watching and evaluating the performances. Are there things that you learned about how to judge a performance as it's happening?
I learned more about diplomacy than anything else.
Such as?
Well, Dad rarely spoke out loud to an actor. If Dad had an observation to make to an actor, he usually drew them to one side and would whisper his suggestion. And often it wouldn't even be a suggestion. He'd ask them a question. He was a careful midwife who knew the project was going to be born, and it was just a question of whether it could be born with all its faculties.
Now, according to your father's autobiography, you were born while... and it's proven in that book. Now, he says that you were born while he was preparing to do The African Queen. And it made me think that every step of the way in your life must have coincided with some movie that he was making. How important were movies in your life? Did you see a lot of them, especially during the years that you were in Ireland? Did you care a lot about movies?
No. The first picture I was on was Moby Dick, and I entered at the crucial stage where Gregory Peck was strapped to a great big piece of white blubber and was being hosed down. This did make an unforgettable impression. On the other hand, I've really become firmly embedded in movies at a rather late stage, and I now understand why that happened, which is that if you grow up in movies, you don't have enough experience of the ordinary world. And it seems to me that writers in particular should have profound experience in a number of fields that are as far removed from writing as possible.
Your father ends his autobiography with some advice to the young. He says he's always asked, what would you do if you had it to do all over again? And the first thing he answers in response to that is, I would spend more time with my children. How did you feel when you read that in his book?
Well, at that time, I have three children, and I was doing exactly what Dad recommended, but unconsciously. I missed the fact that I didn't see Dad much as a child. On the other hand, Dad, in my case, indeed in the case of all of us children, he did it exactly the wrong way round. We didn't see Dad when we were children, but at the end of his life, we saw more of him than we saw of anybody else. And, of course, this had a wonderful effect upon all of us.
What kinds of screenplays would you like to do now? What kind of writing would you like to do now?
I've just finished another screenplay based on the famous duel between Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr. And that's a wonderful project. I'm delighted with it, and I can't be accused of having James Joyce there in the background.
Well, Tony Houston, I want to thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Tony Houston spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in Los Angeles. Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Robert Siegel and see what they have planned. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What story is he following?
Well, we're following up still the president's news conference from last night, the clarifications issued in Washington, some thoughts on the president's performance from his former communications director, David Gergen. Also a report from Linda Wertheimer, who's been following the campaign of Democratic presidential aspirant Jesse Jackson, and a talk with Albertina Sisulu, one of the leaders of the South African UDF, one of the groups banned and further restricted by yesterday's South African government decree. She calls for sanctions on trade and investment by the United States in South Africa.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Roman Polanski is the director of such critically acclaimed films as Rosemary's Baby, Knife in the Water, Tess, Chinatown, and Repulsion. Polanski has a new movie opening this week called Frantic. It stars Harrison Ford. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
To anyone interested in movies, watching Roman Polanski direct is a real treat. He's a crafty little leprechaun, leaping among the actors, the cameramen, the gaffers, and set designers, jabbering nonstop, telling filthy jokes and poking his head into everybody's business. One minute he grabs a hammer from a set carpenter and shows him how it's done. The next he's arranging the lights, while the cinematographer, the man in charge of those lights, gapes. And he does all this without incurring the least resentment from anyone, because, as they'll be the first to tell you, he knows their jobs better than they do. As an all-round film technician, Polanski has few peers. Even as his new movie, Frantic, falls to pieces before your eyes, you can sense Polanski's expertise. He has an extraordinary command of the details, and it's details that make the first half of this thriller gripping. The movie begins as a San Francisco doctor, played by Harrison Ford, and his wife, played by Betty Buckley, arrive in Paris. It's early morning, because that's when flights arrive in Paris, and Polanski handles their protracted arrival beautifully. It's a tour de force of observation that any seasoned traveler will recognize frame by frame and moment by moment, from check-in to room service. Then, while Ford is in the shower, the phone rings. His wife answers, and a few moments later leaves the room. She doesn't return. By midday, it's become clear that she's been kidnapped, and Ford's search for her leads him into a world of drugs and thugs and night-blossoming good-time girls, particularly one played by a heavy-lidded beauty named Emmanuelle Seignier.
But they want my suitcase. Why do they take your wife?
When I find them, I'll ask them. Who hired you?
Dede hired me.
Who hired Dede?
I don't know. If they knew me, they would kill me. I gave them the wrong suitcase this morning, and instead they killed Dede.
No, I don't think so.
You think I lie?
What did you bring back from San Francisco? Was it dope?
No.
Isn't that what you do for a living, smuggle dope?
Not this time.
Harrison Ford spends most of this movie regarding Emmanuelle Seignier as though she were some ungainly form of insect life, and the plot doesn't thicken so much as it fattens. The number of implausibilities per scene brims over into double digits, and yet Polanski's craftsmanship keeps its hold on your attention. The sardonic humor one recalls from his early movies comes into play every time a pair of bumblers from the American embassy tries to lend a helping hand. And Polanski plays with props and settings and the temperaments of his villains with an elan that kept reminding me of Hitchcock. Unfortunately, as the movie reaches its second hour, Polanski devotes more and more screen time to Emmanuelle Seignier, which is his right. She is, after all, his girlfriend of the moment. But Seignier is no actress, and Polanski never succeeds in fleshing out her character. She's supposed to be an amoral street girl who develops a conscience and a heart of gold. By the film's climax, she's become the picture's chief interest, which is why the movie loses hours. It isn't the first time that Polanski's love life has interfered with his art, but then Frantic marks the first time in a decade that Polanski's art has been so abundantly evident.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, I'll talk with Charles Burns, who writes and draws comic books for adults. These comics are grotesque stories of alienation. His new book of comics, Hard-Boiled Defective Stories, is part of the new Raw series. Also, jazz pianist Sumi Tonooka will play an excerpt from Out of Silence, a composition inspired by her mother's internment in a camp for Japanese Americans during World War II. And Ken Tucker will review the home video cassette, TV's Best Adventures of Superman. The release coincides with the 50th anniversary of Superman's appearance as a comic strip character. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.